Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Healthy Skeptic Podcast. My name is Danny Roddy, and with me is Chris Kresser, health detective and creator of thehealthyskeptic.org, a blog challenging mainstream myths about nutrition and health. Chris, I missed you last week. How are you doing, buddy?
Yeah, we missed you, Danny. I don't know if you had a chance to listen to it, but it was a lot of fun.
I did. Emily is truly amazing. I really enjoyed the episode.
Yeah, she is a popular guest, too. We got a lot of comments saying best podcast ever, so.
Oh, wow.
We'll have to have her back for sure.
Awesome. How's the lady? How's the forthcoming baby?
Both good, as far as I can tell. I mean, there's a fully formed baby in there, so it could be any day. Could be today. It could be 2 weeks from now. We really don't know. But we're sort of making predictions just because it's fun. And my prediction is 2 or 3 days before the due date, which would be like the 14th or the 15th. But it's just a wild guess. We have no idea.
It could be during this podcast.
Who knows? Stranger things have happened. You'll forgive me if I have to stop in the middle of it. How about you? What's happening?
Nothing new. As I told you, I just moved, but really keeping busy with summer school, and that's pretty much it.
So that's biology now?
Yeah, biology, taking some general ed classes like English and communications. Mm-hmm. I'm really lucky I get to take these accelerated classes, which are, in my opinion, way easier. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting it kind of all done super fast since I didn't do it when I was doing the whole band thing.
Yeah.
But
nice.
Yeah.
Glad you got out of that stupid nutrition program.
Yeah, that was, I sat in the back and didn't raise my hand anymore, and that kind of solved the issue.
Right. All right, so today's topic is everybody's favorite topic, manopause.
Manopause, best topic ever.
Male, otherwise known as male menopause or andropause, if we want to get technical.
Chris, beginning question, does this hit men at any age? Is it a certain age? Or do you see men all across the board with this?
It certainly can happen earlier rather than later. It's not typical to see it in, you know, the early 20s, but it can. And we're going to cover why that is. Menopause, and, you know, just to back up a little bit in case some of our listeners don't know what menopause or andropause is. It's basically usually a slow but steady reduction of the production of testosterone and dihydrotestosterone, which are the main androgens or male hormones. And then the consequences of that reduction, which is usually associated with the decrease in Leydig cells in the testicles. So menopause, as you hinted, is a little bit different than menopause in this way. In the case of menopause, there's usually a pretty dramatic and abrupt shift that happens in female hormone levels. And any woman that's gone through menopause and experienced it in this way will tell you how abrupt and dramatic it can be. But the changes that happen in male reproductive hormones are often, but not always, more subtle. And they tend to occur more gradually through life. But as with menopause, these changes can have pretty serious implications. For example, that in the 10, I know we talked about this before in a previous show, but the 10 most common causes of death in males are heart disease, cancer, accidents or unintentional injuries, stroke, lower respiratory diseases, diabetes, flu and pneumonia, suicide, kidney disease, and Alzheimer's. And when you look at those 10 causes, it's pretty clear that andropause can play a role in nearly all of them, if not all of them.
Oh, totally.
So it's definitely a serious problem. And I don't know. I haven't seen any solid data on this, but just anecdotally, you know, having been in practice for a while and even back into my student days, it seems to me that I'm seeing more men with these complaints. What do you think? I mean, I know because of the work with hair loss, and since that's a major symptom of it, you must see some of this too.
Totally. I think it really comes apparent when people approach me at work. I'm like known as the health guy, and and I, like, as you know, I think people are really willing to share information with you that they wouldn't otherwise. So people always say like, I have digestive issues, or I have like no libido, and it's I don't know if I'm just privy to that information, but it's definitely something that happens like common. It's commonly happened. So definitely.
And I'm seeing it more in younger guys at this point too.
In
their 30s and 40s, and even some in their 20s. So we'll talk a little bit more about how that could be possible. And it'll make a lot of sense once we get into the patterns. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about basic male hormone physiology, because it's important to understand how that works in order to really get the mechanisms that occur when things go wrong. So male hormone production, and any hormone production, male or female, involves the hypothalamus in the brain and the pituitary, and in the case of males, involves the testicles, and in females, involves the ovaries, and to a lesser degree in both, the adrenals. So the whole process starts with gonadotropin-releasing hormone, or GnRH, which is produced in the hypothalamus. And then at the level of the pituitary, GnRH stimulates the release of FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone, and LH, which is luteinizing hormone. And then that it kind of breaks off in two different directions. So LH acts on the Leydig cells in the testicles, which produce testosterone. And then that testosterone is converted into dihydrotestosterone, which is a downstream metabolite of testosterone that's about 10 times more metabolically active. And the enzyme 5-alpha reductase is involved in that conversion. And we'll come back to that later, because one of the pathologies of menopause involves that enzyme. And then in the other pathway, FSH acts on the Sertoli cells in the testicles, which produce sperm. So keep in mind that the production of testosterone depends on precursor hormones like 17-hydroxyprogesterone, pregnenolone, and DHEA, all of which can be depleted in the stress response and diverted into cortisol production. So, for example, if you've got too much stress, that can deplete these testosterone precursor hormones and lead to lower levels of testosterone. And we'll talk more about that later, too. It's also important to understand how hormone regulation works in general in the body. It's a negative feedback system. So one analogy I like to use is you can think of the pituitary gland as a control tower, and it basically sits up in the brain monitoring hormone levels in the blood. And if a hormone level is low, for example, if testosterone is low, then the pituitary will pick up on that, and it will increase the production of the stimulating hormone, in this case LH, that acts on the Leydig cells to produce more testosterone. On the other hand, if testosterone were high, then you would see a decrease in LH, so that the testicles would produce less. And that's basically how it works with any hormone in the body. And it's a really exquisitely controlled and regulated system. There are still parts of it that we don't really understand that well. So it's important to keep that in mind, because when we talk about things like testosterone replacement therapy or hormone replacement therapy, one of the issues with it is that it disrupts that, carefully orchestrated natural regulation in the hormone, in the negative feedback system, and we'll talk more about that as well.
Chris, are you saying I can't balance the delicate symphony that is the hormonal system with testosterone cream?
That is what I'm saying. we're going to talk a lot about this, but I do also want to say that there are some cases probably where testosterone replacement is helpful. And so I'm not saying there's no place for it and it's never beneficial or useful. I'm just saying it certainly should not be the first thing that somebody tries. And I'm also suggesting that it really depends on the mechanism, you need to figure out why testosterone levels are low and then address the particular mechanism. Otherwise, it's just a Band-Aid solution. And then, of course, as you're implying, and as we've already talked about, it can, you can end up causing more problems than you're trying to fix. So let's talk about five main patterns of menopause. So these are like five, at least as far as I've seen in my practice and in the literature, these are five typical presentations of menopause. So number one would be overconversion of testosterone into estrogen via aromatization. And as you know, males should be androgen dominant or testosterone dominant. And if a lot of testosterone gets converted into estrogen, then all kinds of problems ensue. One interesting thing is that in males, testosterone is actually protective against heart disease, whereas in females, estrogen is protective against heart disease. So in males, when they become estrogen dominant, they become more susceptible to heart disease. And I think that's actually one thing that's not really talked about very often in terms of this increasing rates of heart disease, is this pattern of menopause and how that is contributing to the increased risk of heart disease. And in women, it's the opposite. You know, when women convert too much estrogen into testosterone, which is common with PCOS and caused by insulin resistance, then their risk for heart disease goes up.
Is there a known mechanism for how testosterone protects the heart?
There probably is, but I can't tell you what it is. You know, my sense of it is just that, again, that there's such a delicate balance of hormones in the system, and hormones regulate so many different processes. And if that goes out of whack, then, you know, pretty much everything can go out of whack along with it. So number two would be increased production of sex hormone binding globulin, which then leads to low levels of free testosterone. So in order to get this, we need to explain a little bit more about how hormone regulation works in the body. Generally, when hormones are produced by the gland that produces them, they are attached to a carrier protein. And that's because hormones are not water soluble or soluble in the blood. They're fat soluble. So they need to be, in order to be transported through the blood, they need to be attached to a protein carrier. In the case of thyroid, that carrier is thyroid binding globulin. But in the case of sex hormones, it's sex hormone binding globulin. However, in order for the hormone to become biologically active and act on the tissue or the cell, it needs to be cleaved from that carrier protein. And once it becomes cleaved from that carrier protein, it's then referred to as free hormone. So once testosterone is cleaved from sex hormone binding globulin, it becomes free testosterone. So this is why, you know, you hear people emphasizing the importance of testing free hormone levels rather than just the protein-bound hormones. Because protein-bound hormones, it's still important to test that because it gives you, that's what tells you how the gland is functioning. You know, the protein-bound hormone levels tell you how much of a hormone that the gland is actually producing. But it's also important to test the free levels because that tells you how much of the hormone is actually biologically active. So in this pattern that we're talking about here, you get an increased production of the carrier protein, sex hormone binding globulin, which if you follow, the more carrier proteins you have, the less free testosterone will be left over to act on the tissues.
Bad news.
Bad news. No fun. So pattern number three is Leydig cell failure. So the Leydig cells that produce the testosterone have failed or are not functioning properly. And then you'll get an elevated level of LH because of that negative feedback system we described earlier, where, you know, Leydig cells are not producing testosterone. The levels of testosterone are low as a result. And then the pituitary picks up on that and it cranks up the level of luteinizing hormone in order to stimulate more testosterone production. But because the Leydig cells aren't working well, they don't get that memo, or they become insensitive to it in the same way that cells can become insulin resistant. So the pituitary is like shouting, you know, at the testicles and the Leydig cells, telling it to produce more. But it can't hear that message. So that's usually secondary to inflammation, which we're going to talk a lot more about. Pattern number four would be upregulation of 5-alpha reductase, which is the enzyme that converts testosterone into dihydrotestosterone. And that can lead to an increased production of dihydrotestosterone, which can cause problems like benign prostate hyperplasia, BPH, and, as of course you will know, Danny, can cause hair loss.
Yes.
There's another pattern, which would be a downregulation of 5-alpha reductase, which is less common, where you see elevated levels of testosterone, or elevated or normal testosterone, but low levels of DHT. And since DHT is so much more potent than testosterone in its metabolic effect, low levels of DHT can lead to some of the symptoms of hypogonadism or andropause.
Chris, I'm sorry, this is a wild guess, but is it true that the more DHT one has, the more beard and auxiliary hair they usually have? To my understanding, DHT is responsible for a lot of male characteristics like beard growth.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, we probably all have that guy that we grew up with who got a beard when he was in fifth grade. I won't name any names, but if anyone who we went to school with is listening to this show, they'll know who I'm talking about. But poor guy got a lot of pretty hard time. But I mean, seriously, he could like go into a liquor store and buy beers when he was in sixth grade. But yeah, I think he had some extra DHT floating around in his system. So pattern number five is chronic stress, which depresses pituitary function. And depressing pituitary function can lead to decreased levels of LH and FSH, which of course are the stimulating hormones that tell the Leydig cells and the Sertoli cells to produce testosterone and sperm. So this is one of the mechanisms by which stress can not only cause andropause, but can cause infertility. Because if you have a decrease in sperm production, that's obviously not going to increase your chances of conception. So now let's talk a little bit. Those are the five main patterns, but the obvious question is what causes those patterns to happen? What are the main mechanisms that lead to those patterns? And this, of course, is going to inform how we deal with them. So the first one is insulin resistance. And keep in mind, as we talk about each of these mechanisms, in most cases, each mechanism contributes to most, if not all, of the five patterns that we just talked about. It's sort of a cycle, you know. So some of the mechanism, like insulin resistant, will cause one of the patterns, and then one of those patterns contributes to some of the other patterns, and then you get into that whole downward spiral thing. So insulin resistance and low testosterone have been shown in several different studies to occur together in diabetic men. They're associated because insulin upregulates the production of aromatase. Now, if we talked about this in that first pattern, the overconversion of testosterone into estrogen via aromatization. So aromatase is the enzyme that converts testosterone into estrogen. And so what happens is when you have elevated insulin or insulin resistance, you get an increase in that enzyme aromatase, and then you get an increased conversion of testosterone into estrogen. Now, elevated estrogen levels increase the production of sex hormone binding globulin. And as we just discussed, that will decrease the level of free testosterone. And a third way that insulin resistance mucks everything up is that it, of course, contributes to weight gain. And we know now that adipocytes, or fat cells from body fat, release interleukin-6, which is an inflammatory cytokine that contributes to menopause in several different ways. And we're going to talk about that next when we talk about inflammation. And then finally, insulin resistance also triggers the release of GnRH. And so hypogonadism could be the result of insulin resistance that's occurring at the level of the hypothalamus. Okay, so now let's move on to the next mechanism, which is inflammation. And interesting thing about this, as I said, is that all of these things start to interrelate and it becomes a really nasty, vicious cycle. So if you've read my series on diabesity, you know that insulin resistance can contribute to inflammation and inflammation can contribute to insulin resistance. So just keep that in mind as we talk about this stuff. So inflammation can reduce testosterone production in several different ways. Inflammatory cytokines can alter the growth and differentiation of Leydig cells. And they can also inhibit the production of testosterone by Leydig cells at the transcriptional level of the steroidogenic enzymes. I know that was a mouthful, but so in other words, inflammation suppresses the transcription of enzymes which are needed to produce testosterone. And then inflammation can cause testicular resistance to LH, which is what we were just talking about before. And I was saying like how the pituitary is shouting at the testicles, to produce more sperm or testosterone, but the testicles can't hear because they're resistant to LH. It's, you know, the same phenomenon as insulin resistance or thyroid hormone resistance. Now, the third main mechanism is stress. And again, stress can lead to elevated cortisol levels. We've talked about this ad nauseum and, you know, lots of different times. Cortisol levels, when they're elevated, disrupt blood sugar regulation, and that can lead to insulin resistance. We know that calorie restriction, like long-term dieting and poor sleep, have both been shown to alter the secretion of GnRH and LH, which in turn would decrease testosterone levels. I saw a study where daytime testosterone levels were decreased by 10 to 15% in young men who were otherwise healthy who underwent just a week of sleep restriction to 5 hours per night. So that's a condition that 15% of the U.S. working population experiences, is, you know, like a either working the night shift or working a late shift so that they can only get 5 or 6 hours of sleep per night. And in just 1 week of that, testosterone levels were decreased by 10 to 15%. Now, compare that to a decrease in testosterone levels of 1 to 2% per year, which is associated with normal aging. That's a pretty big difference. And these men, you know, the symptoms we're talking about here are things like low energy, reduced libido, poor concentration, increased sleepiness, and then more significant stuff like increased risk of heart disease, increased risk for dementia and Alzheimer's, which we'll talk about in a second. And, you know, all of the major causes of death that we talked about before. So the last thing I want to talk about before we get into prevention and treatment and some of the questions is testosterone in the brain and the relationship between the two. So in addition to the stuff that we just covered, low testosterone can also alter mood and memory and the ability to concentrate. And this is why loss of testosterone is associated with dementia and Alzheimer's. On the other hand, when you have decreased blood flow to the brain and activation of the microglia, which are the immune cells in the brain, and, you know, microglia activation of the brain equals inflammation of the brain, that can in turn suppress the function of the hypothalamus and the pituitary and lead to low testosterone levels. We know that long-term elevations of LH, which occur in testicular resistance, which is, again, secondary to inflammation, can promote degeneration of the hippocampus. And the hippocampus is the part of the brain that is affected and degenerated in Alzheimer's and dementia. The hippocampus also controls cortisol rhythm. And so this is another vicious cycle that you get into where you get an elevation of LH that degenerates the hippocampus. The hippocampus controls cortisol rhythm. So then you get a disturbed cortisol rhythm, which causes more stress and more inflammation, which leads to further degeneration of the hippocampus, you know, and we're off to the races. One interesting thing, too, is that a lot of recent research suggests that erectile dysfunction in men is generally not an endocrine problem. You know, it's not a problem with hormone regulation as much as it's a problem, a vascular and neurologic problem. So what's happening is there's not enough blood flow to the peripheries, and that's what's causing the erectile dysfunction rather than a hormone imbalance. And a couple of recent studies that I saw suggested that erectile dysfunction may actually be the first sign of systemic vascular disease, or, you know, cardiovascular problems. In other words, erectile dysfunction might be an early indicator, early warning of future cardiovascular complications because of the relationship with blood flow there. Okay, so let's just talk a little bit in a general sense about prevention and treatment, because that's all we can really do without, you know, I always harp on this, but it's really different for every individual because each individual is going to have a different presentation with different mechanisms, different patterns, and it's really important to identify what those patterns are to get, you know, to create the most effective treatment. And that's why I'm never comfortable just saying, you know, go out and take Tribulus or, you know, take, you know, Gymnema or this, because it's kind of a shotgun approach. It might work if you happen to be one of the people that, you know, where your LH is decreased, and that's the mechanism, and Tribulus increases it and you get lucky. But if you're not, it's not going to help, and at worst it could cause harm. So let's talk a little bit, I know we've already covered this, but let's talk again about why testosterone replacement isn't the best place to start. So we talked about the whole negative feedback system earlier in the podcast. And what happens then, if you take a testosterone cream and you rub it on your skin, there's a few things there. Number one, I explained earlier that the body has a really complicated way of determining hormone balance. And beyond that, it decides in a way that we don't fully understand yet when to cleave the free hormone from its protein carrier and make it active to the tissues. So the body orchestrates that process in a way that we don't understand. And what happens when you take testosterone cream is that that's free testosterone in that cream. So it goes right into your blood, into your tissues and your bloodstream as free testosterone. So the body has no ability to regulate how much free testosterone is available to the tissues when you take the cream, because it just enters the tissues in the free form. Body has no choice about cleaving it from a protein carrier. So that's problem number one. Problem number two, which is the more general problem, is that as the levels of testosterone rise in the tissue, because of the negative feedback system, the pituitary will produce less LH and FSH to try to compensate. But because it's not the glands that are producing that excess hormone, it's coming from outside of the body, the decrease in LH and FSH doesn't really have any effect. And you often see a further decrease in LH and FSH as the body scrambles to compensate for the increased testosterone levels. Now, that means, of course, that you'll have decreased internal production of testosterone. And then what happens in any case where there's excess hormone floating around is that the cellular receptor sites for that hormone will become downregulated. It's a smart way that the body has of protecting itself from too much hormone exposure. So not only do the receptor sites become less sensitive to that hormone, like testosterone in this case, you'll actually see a decrease in the overall number of receptor sites on the cell. And then what happens at that point is that you'll need to take more testosterone cream to get the same effect, because you have fewer receptors and the receptors you do have are less sensitive. And then the LH and FSH continue to decrease, which means you're producing internally less and less testosterone. And so over time, a guy who's on the cream might need to take more and more to have the same effect, keep increasing the dose. And then at some point they just might give up. It's not working anymore. And then they stop the cream. So what do you suppose happens then?
A world of hurt.
Yeah, exactly. Because when they stop the cream, they have few receptors. The receptors they do have are totally insensitive, and their LH and FSH are completely depressed from all of the time on the cream. So they're not producing any of their own hormone. And when I see this in my practice, I tell people, honestly, like, this is going to suck. You know, you're going to be in a world of hurt for a few months as we deal with this situation, and there's no way around it, unfortunately. I actually don't take people off cold turkey because of this. I usually try to, titrate them off over time. But inevitably there's a period of where, we remove the external support and the internal production has not caught up yet. But the good news is that receptor sites can come back. So once the body figures out that there isn't any excess in the tissues anymore, then the LH and FSH will start to come back, and the internal production of the hormone will start to come back. And then the number of receptor sites will increase, and the sensitivity of the receptor sites that exist will increase. So it is reversible in many cases.
Would you put a number on that for how long that takes for gentlemen?
I definitely would not.
I know it's different for everybody, but like a couple months?
Months. Like, it's a function of how long they've been on the cream, of course, and then how downregulated their receptors and LH and FSH are. But in general, I would say that the transition period is at least 2 months, and maybe somewhere between 2 to 4 months. And it's not like there's nothing changing during that time. There's a gradual shift happening, but it can be difficult for those couple of months for sure. So what else can be done? If not TRT or testosterone replacement therapy, what can we do? Of course, the answer depends on first identifying the underlying mechanism. That's always more than half the battle. So is it, which pattern is it? Is it aromatization, overconversion of testosterone into estrogen? Is it inflammation? Is it stress? Is it all of the above? And then, of course, once you figure out what that pattern is, you've got to address it at that root level. So if it's insulin resistance, you've got to address glucose tolerance and blood sugar regulation, insulin sensitivity. If it's inflammation, you need to look at first, of course, at diet. Are there food toxins in the diet that are contributing to inflammation? Is there overtraining happening? Is there, some other cause of inflammation, like a chronic infection that hasn't been identified? You've got to look at stress and sleep, which I think seriously, probably 90% or maybe 95% of cases of andropause, stress and sleep, and sleep deprivation is running the show. It's the thing that people have the most trouble focusing on, especially men, it seems. And it's one of the hardest things to focus on, as we've talked about a lot. It's a lot easier to take, Tribulus or some other supplement than it is to really radically change one's lifestyle. So if adrenal stress is the primary driver, which it often is, then stress management programs like mindfulness-based stress reduction or the Rest Assured program, which you can get at soundersleep.com. We've talked about these before. Herbal adaptogens can be helpful. Things like ginseng, rhodiola, ashwagandha, eleutherococcus. These are botanicals that can increase cortisol when it's low and decrease it when it's high, which is the definition of an adaptogen. It's a pretty neat thing that plant medicine can do that drugs can't do generally. Then there's phosphatidylserine, which protects the integrity of the hippocampus, helps regulate the cortisol rhythm. helps with cognitive function overall. Those are some basic ideas. And of course, if there's insulin sensitivity, you've got to take care of the diet. But if you've already taken care of the diet and you still are dealing with glucose intolerance or insulin sensitivity, things like gymnema, which is an herb that's been used in Ayurvedic tradition in India for many, hundreds or thousands of years to decrease sugar cravings and improve insulin sensitivity and glucose tolerance. Magnesium is really good for that. Green tea extract and alpha lipoic acid can be helpful. Then there's chrysin, which has come up before. That chrysin is one of the few compounds that we know of that inhibits aromatization, which is, that overconversion of testosterone to estrogen. So if that pattern is present, in addition to, of course, doing everything you can to reduce insulin resistance, chrysin might be helpful. And then maca and tribulus increase LH production. And of course, these are the two of the supplements that you see on the internet recommended all the time. Like if you have low testosterone, take tribulus and maca. It's not that simple, but because, consider this possibility. Let's say the mechanism is testicular resistance and you actually have high LH. Taking maca and tribulus is not going to help that problem and arguably could make it worse by increasing the testicular resistance. So, but if you do have decreased LH production, and this is what we would suspect, like for a guy who's been on testosterone replacement therapy and is coming off of it, we would expect their LH and FSH production to be low. And I've found in these circumstances that maca and tribulus can be helpful in bringing LH production back up to a normal level.
I was going to throw in, working with somebody like yourself might be the key to getting these herbs to actually function correctly.
Yeah, or finding anybody who has this kind of perspective, a functional perspective, who's looking at the underlying mechanism, doing the appropriate testing to determine what that mechanism is, and then creating a treatment plan that's based on that data, rather than just prescribing an herb for a symptom.
Because, herbs are can be equated to almost like medication.
Absolutely. They're very potent. And a lot of people don't understand that. There's a sad story. I haven't talked to this guy in a while. He is a patient. And I might, since it's been a while, I might be screwing up the details. But he took an herbal formula. It was, something he got off the internet, and it was for andropause or testosterone. He had, borderline low levels of testosterone, and it had an herb in it. I can't remember the name of the herb right now, but it's one of the herbs, that you see recommended a lot for increasing testosterone. Not a lot. It's actually kind of a lesser known one, actually. And he had complete irreversible, at least up until now, impotence that after taking this product formula, like it changed something really significantly. I only spoke to him once. I think we did an initial consult and he told me about it and then I didn't talk to him. I'm not sure what he ended up doing, but so
did you guys ever end up doing blood work or anything?
No, we didn't. He didn't follow through. I'm not sure what he ended up deciding to do, but, that's rare. It's not like you hear about that often, but it does underscore the importance of finding some help with this sort of thing, because one of the things about herbs is that they're not regulated by the FDA. And in some ways, I think that's a good thing, because I certainly don't want the FDA deciding what herbs I can prescribe or not, But the downside of that is that there's a lot of variation in quality out there. And I've being an herbalist, I've studied this in depth, and I can tell you firsthand that there's a huge, huge difference in the quality of herbal products out there. The typical Chinese herb product has been harvested, you know, 10 years ago. It then sits in a warehouse in these big open bins in China, you know, for 4 or 5 years more than that, before it finally makes its way over, you know, to the US or gets included in a product. And the herbs that I use in my practice are sourced in a really different way. You know, one of the companies I use is in Marin County, and they try to use as many fresh, organic, wildcrafted, local herbs as they can. And the herbs that they do get from China, they get from the number one supplier that, you know, complies with all of the regulations, and, you know, they've been over to visit the factory, and, you know, so there's obviously you're going to pay more for those kind of herbs, but, for me, it's worth it because I know that they work and they're way more potent than herbs that have been out of the ground for 10 years and sitting in a bin, you know, in a factory. And, they're also safer. So
that natural calm news you posted was sobering.
Yeah. And to be fair, there were a lot of good comments and responses to that. I think that article that I came across was a little bit old, like 2 years old. And
oh, really?
The founder of the company has responded to it and, you know, said that they comply with the regulations. And, you know, so there is confusion about that too. You know, sometimes there can be scares that aren't really, you know, that people make more of a big deal of something than should actually be made. But certainly it does highlight the importance of like going with a brand that's really trustworthy, or, you know, with the case of herbs, I think it's generally fairly safe to use single herbs in relatively low doses, depending on the herb. But when you start getting into formulas and when you start getting into using herbs for therapeutic purposes, it's really best to find an herbalist to work with, because you absolutely can cause problems and damage with herbs. So let's get into some questions.
Cool. Okay. This one's from Andrew. This is off your Facebook page, but he asks if vasectomies can contribute to early onset andropause.
That's a great question, actually. And I did a little bit of research on this, and I guess what we could say is the jury's not out, but there is enough research to give me pause, if that was something that I'm considering, which I'm not, obviously. But so there's been some studies. Well, first of all, let's step back a little bit. I mean, the idea that vasectomy is totally safe is not quite accurate. As any man will testify, the testicles are very delicate and sensitive structures. You know, they're complex organs with a really rich nerve and blood and lymph supply, and they're under this intricate hormonal control that we've already talked about during the show, and also intricate temperature control to regulate sperm and testosterone production, because sperm has to be produced in a pretty narrow temperature range. And another thing is that the sperm is really tightly isolated or from the rest of the body, so that the man doesn't produce antibodies to his own sperm, which, you know, as far as the rest of the body is concerned, sperm is a foreign protein. So there are these defenses that keep the sperm isolated from the immune system. Now, all of that intricate hormonal and temperature control, the defenses that keep sperm isolated, the delicate physiological structures can be disrupted even when the vasectomy seems to have gone well. And there can be short and long-term complications, which can be serious. So there's a clinic, the Harley Street Clinic, which is a place where they do a lot of, they specialize in treating andropause, and that some of their own internal research, you know, this isn't double blind placebo controlled stuff, it's anecdotal, but in their experience, over the past 10 years, 25% of men who've come in for treatment for andropause have had a vasectomy. And that's about twice the level in the general population. And in some of the surveys they've done, 35% of men who filled out this andropause checklist and had andropause had reported a vasectomy in the past. And some sister impotence clinics in Australia that they work with have reported a rate as high as 45%. So we don't know for sure what the mechanism is there, but one of the leading theories is autoimmunity related to sperm released into the tissues after the vasectomy. So in other words, that defensive structure that keeps the sperm out, you know, away from the immune system, it is disrupted, and then the immune system becomes aware of the sperm, treats it like a foreign protein, starts producing antibodies to it, and then that becomes, you know, sort of an immunological time bomb. So to summarize, I guess we don't know for absolute sure that vasectomy can increase the risk of andropause, but there certainly is some evidence suggesting that it does. And there are some clinical studies above and beyond the anecdotal studies that I mentioned that have shown increase in anti-sperm antibodies shortly after vasectomy in animal studies. And there's been a couple studies that have shown an increase in LH levels after a vasectomy, which would indicate that, you know, a compromised ability to produce testosterone. And then there's been just some other studies about general increase in autoimmunity after that surgery. So, you know, anytime you have a surgery like that, there's a risk. And so I think it's real, but whether, you know, what the likelihood of something happening is not entirely clear.
Yeah, I won't be getting a vasectomy anytime soon.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I have no judgment, you know, for choices people make in that regard, but just be aware of that there is some risk.
Totally. This one's from Martin. I think we kind of went over this, but if you could give the quick, dirty rundown of the blood markers that you look for that you're concerned with in regards to andropause.
Well, actually, I prefer saliva testing for hormones because it's cheaper to test the free hormone levels that way. And, you know, we mentioned before that you can test either the protein-bound hormones that, you know, to see what's happening with the glandular production, or you can test the free hormones to see what's actually active in the tissues. With blood testing, you can test both free and protein-bound hormones, but the free hormone testing with blood is quite expensive. And saliva hormone, you test free hormones only, and it's much more affordable. So I use a saliva hormone panel in my practice. There are a couple different labs that offer it. There's BioHealth Diagnostics and Diagnostex. And so I test for the steroid hormones, the sex hormones like testosterone, dihydrotestosterone. I always test for estrogen in men too, to see if they're overconverting. You know, that can tell us about aromatization. I test for androstenedione, which is a precursor hormone, and so it's important to know about that. And then because when I'm doing a male hormone panel, I always also run cortisol and DHEA because those are the primary stress hormones, and DHEA being a precursor hormone to the sex hormones and stress hormones, we can find out more about what's happening with the adrenals and how much stress is contributing to the picture. So I usually do a complete hormone panel. Of course, in terms of blood work and basic stuff, you can test your blood sugar. So you can test fasting glucose, A1C, and fructosamine. And then you could also do post-meal blood sugar testing with a glucometer to determine whether your insulin resistance is an issue. Uric acid is another, you know, kind of surrogate marker of insulin resistance and blood sugar regulation. And then in terms of inflammation, you can test for acute phase reactants like ferritin and C-reactive protein. And in terms of autoimmunity, I might look at a CBC, look at the white blood cell count. And you can look for anti-sperm antibodies if you suggest that that's happening, or if there's evidence that that might be happening.
That should definitely get the whole picture if you're doing all that stuff.
Exactly.
This one's from Darius. If when the body is healing, what role does libido/erections play in determining health? When/how does the body divert sexual and reproductive energy into healing? Are andropause symptoms ever a good sign? And just to emphasize, what do you think, is morning erections a good sign of testosterone production?
I don't actually know. Do you?
I mean, from personal experience, I know libido is always higher when that phenomena is happening. Mm-hmm. But I think I used to talk to my old, this like a while ago, anti-aging doctor, and he was super hot on that being a positive sign.
Yeah, it makes sense, but I've just never seen any studies about morning erections being a marker for testosterone. I haven't looked that carefully either, but I think I understand what he's asking, which is essentially, will the body divert resources that would otherwise go into production of male hormones into healing in a chronic illness state?
Probably pretty hard to tell.
Yeah, I think it probably does, though. I mean, because you've got, like I mentioned before, the precursors like pregnenolone and 17-hydroxyprogesterone and DHEA. And there's something called the pregnenolone steal, where pregnenolone is diverted into cortisol production and away from the sex hormone pathway, which would, go into DHEA and then down through the rest of the sex hormones that way. So what you see often in a lab panel when in the pregnenolone steal is high levels of cortisol and low levels of DHEA and low levels of the sex hormones. And, cortisol is one of the major anti-inflammatory hormones. So let's say you've got some kind of chronic illness going that involves an inflammatory component, which almost all chronic illness does. Then you might see increased production of cortisol in order to deal with that inflammation. And that would divert precursor material like pregnenolone into that cortisol pathway and away from the male reproductive pathway. Conceivably also, if you have blood sugar issues like hypoglycemia or reactive hypoglycemia that then cause chronic cortisol secretions to bring blood sugar back up, that could conceivably divert pregnenolone into that cortisol pathway rather than the male reproductive pathway. So yeah, I think it's definitely possible. In terms of whether andropause symptoms are a good sign of healing, I don't know that we could go that far. I think it's more of a sign that the body's in a state that is where it doesn't have enough resources for both the stress, stress tolerance and production of male hormones. So I would interpret it more as a sign of being in a healing state, like, and needing more healing rather than being a good sign of healing.
Awesome. Do you want to get to any of these other questions? And I'll cut this part out.
Yeah, let me.
Because I think we're approaching about an hour.
I can do these next ones in 5 minutes. So
okay.
Let's do the next two.
The John and Mark, or Greg.
Greg and the beer belly one. I mean, they're going to take literally 1 or 2 minutes each. So.
All right. I'll give a little pause. Mm-hmm. Okay, the next question is from Greg. Should andropause be accepted as part of normal physiological decline in males? Or do our lifestyle choices influence this to any great degree, positively or negatively? What do you think, Chris?
I do think that there is almost certainly a normal slight decline in testosterone production as we age. But andropause implies to me kind of a pathological acceleration of that process. So I don't think andropause is necessarily normal, But I do think that some decline in testosterone production as we age is normal. In terms of the second part of the question, I absolutely think that lifestyle choices influence this to a great degree. I think we've covered that extensively. I mean, things like stress management, making sure you get enough sleep, reducing inflammation, improving your glucose tolerance and insulin sensitivity are all lifestyle, definitely lifestyle related. And so that can play a really significant role in how we age and whether we experience andropause or not as men.
I like this next question. I have a friend who is approaching 50. He has a beer belly or gluten belly and what he refers to as man boobs. He's a major workaholic stress monster and fears his mortality and fears the loss of the use of his manhood. Mm-hmm. I've heard it said that belly and boobs are indicators of too much estrogen. Is he bringing on his andropause at an alarming rate by not treating himself better? Where should he start to repair what he has done to himself? Perhaps he needs to stop by your office.
Yeah.
And I apologize. I don't have the name for that gentleman that wrote in.
Yeah. Yes. Beer belly, wheat belly, gluten belly, and man boobs can all be signs of estrogen dominance in a male, particularly the man boobs. I mean, wheat belly or beer belly could be a sign of visceral fat accumulation due to increased cortisol levels or insulin resistance or both. But man boobs are pretty sure characteristic sign of estrogen dominance.
I think hyperprolactinemia causes that.
That's another potential cause for sure. But hyperprolactinemia can cause hypogonadism, which would cause estrogen dominance. So
totally.
He is probably bringing on andropause by not treating himself better. I would say, a food toxin-free diet, which we've, like a paleo template type of approach, making sure to reduce processed and refined grains and seed oils and soy and eating, plenty of healthy saturated fat. We're not going to talk about macronutrient ratio because we know by now that there are many different macronutrient ratios for different people, right?
Yes.
And then probably stress reduction is going to be the major factor for this guy. Workaholic stress monster does not seem like a good.
What about fears losing?
Fears loss his mortality and the loss of his
loss
manhood.
Of the use of his
the
manhood.
Use of his manhood. Yeah. So certainly stress management, and I work pretty hard and I work a lot right now, but I do make an effort to, I'm still able to fit it in. And even if it's 5 or 10 minutes a day, that can have a really profound effect. So, being too busy is not an excuse. I mean, it's not one that really holds water anyways. And, or put another way, I mean, yeah, fine. If you say you're too busy for stress reduction, then you're just going to have to deal with the consequences of it, And I don't say that without compassion. I just say, you got to make time for it, I think everyone can find 5 or 10 extra minutes in a day. And I haven't, found anyone that's so busy that there aren't 5 or 10 minutes that they spend extra on, like, Facebook or Twitter or something else that they couldn't spend just sitting in a chair, closing their eyes and doing 5 or 10 minutes of stress reduction.
But now they're all going to be Google plussing.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah. Anybody have an invite? Please send one to me. That's all I need is a whole nother thing like that. Anyways, who knows? Maybe Google Plus will be the best thing since sliced bread and I'll be all over it, but I doubt it. So that's it. I think that's the last of our questions, huh?
Yeah, great episode. Awesome. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was fun. And, we'd always love to hear your feedback and questions. So, you can post them on when we post this blog post in the comments section, and, I'll probably be changing dirty diapers at that point in the middle of the night. So I may not be able to answer immediately, but eventually I'll try to get to them.
Chris, where can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
TheHealthySkeptic.org. I'm in the middle of a series on natural childbirth. Just wrote the first article, which looked at the idea that the mistaken idea that hospital birth is safer than home birth. And I've got a few other articles planned in that series, which I may or, you know, I may get to the next one before the baby comes, or I may not. Also, healthybabycode.com if you're interested in nutrition for fertility, pregnancy, and breastfeeding. And that's about it.
You can find all my work at DannyRoddy.com. Keep sending us your questions at thehealthyskeptic.org using the podcast submission link. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, head over to the iTunes, and leave us a review. Thanks for listening, guys.
Thanks, everybody.